88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. We'll start with this month's installment of our Accountability Index. The Baltimore Development Corporation has recommended a $535 million bond deal to help Under Armour CEO Kevin Plank realize his dream of a city within a city in Port Covington. The BDC made the call in meetings in which the press and the public weren't allowed. Was that a violation of open meeting laws? I'll ask Fern Shen of the Baltimore Brew and veteran freelance reporter Joan Jacobson. Then another in our series of conversations about Baltimore a year after the violence and unrest that followed the funeral of Freddie Gray. ProPublica reporter Alec McGillis on the intersection of transportation policy and deeply rooted racial and economic inequality. Plus, the Monument Quilt, two local artists and activists who are working to stop the scourge of sexual assault. First, the news.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Welcome to the show this morning on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. We're going to begin today with this month's installment of the Accountability Index, our series with reporters from the Baltimore Brew, in which we examine issues of fiscal and policy accountability in state and local government. We began this series last November. We've talked about everything from construction delays and budget problems on local road projects to the status of Baltimore City's audit process and the issues around campaign financing in the very crowded race for mayor of Baltimore. Today, a conversation about the decision to grant a $535 million TIF, or tax incremental financing, to the huge project being proposed by Kevin Plank and Under Armour at Port Covington. The decision to recommend approval of this historically large TIF was reached in three meetings of the Baltimore Development Corporation that were putatively public meetings. Fern Shen of the Baltimore Brew and a number of other local reporters attempted to attend and report on those meetings, and they were turned away. Fern Shen joins me in the studio along with Joan Jacobson, a veteran freelance reporter who has written about TIFs for the Daily Record in a special series on the East Baltimore Development Project back in 2011. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning. Great to be
here. So, Joan, let me start with you. What is a TIF? Give us a little primer on what these things are, because people hear tax incremental financing, right, and it sounds like it's a tax on the citizens of Baltimore.
Right. It is a controversial form of raising millions of dollars for city development projects. But it's different from other bond issues because they are repaid by taxes from the future buildings that will be developed under a project, so that those taxes do not go into the general fund, do not pay for education, do not pay for police. In Baltimore, the TIFs, the repayment schedules go for 30 years. So, for example, in the case of East Baltimore Development.
And that we should say is
North of Johns Hopkins Hospital, which is much delayed because of the recession and because of the poor location of it. The city sold $78 million in bonds, and the developer is supposed to be repaying that with tax money, which is, I don't think, going very well.
Because if they're not developing anything,
if they don't have enough buildings, there's no tax money. Now, TIFs are new to Baltimore. They actually date back elsewhere to 1952 in California. They were been used heavily in Wisconsin and in Chicago. Mark Reuter in The Brew wrote a wonderful story about TIFs recently, in which he said that William Donald Schaefer, the former mayor and governor of Baltimore and Maryland, was opposed to TIFs because he thought they were handouts to developers, which is says a lot because he was the king of handouts to developers. So Baltimore is new to TIFs, and when I was writing about them in 2010, 2011, I found that the city council members who approved the East Baltimore TIF had no idea what a TIF was. They had no idea what they were approving. So
really, these are people on the council telling you, we don't know what TIFs are.
Jack Young, Warren Branch, and Carl Stokes at the time did not know what a TIF was, did not understand what they were approving. Now, since then, I hope they have. I know that Carl Stokes certainly has become a
right, he's
chief
made it a fundament
opponent.
Of his
He's opponent
campaign.
Of TIFs now. He understands what they are. Mm-hmm. So, and voters do not get to approve TIFs, unlike other bonds. So all the more reason for the Baltimore Development Corporation to open its doors to the meetings in consideration of TIFs.
Okay, and let's make a distinction between TIFs and pilots, which are payment in lieu of taxes.
Okay, a payment in lieu of taxes is a basically allowing a developer of a project to pay a tiny amount of what would have been the taxes.
Right, so that's just different. Forgiving the taxes.
That's forgiving the taxes for many years, often decades. TIFs, you pay the taxes, but the taxes go to repay the investors of the bonds, and so the taxpayers in the general fund get gypped out of those taxes. Mm-hmm.
And Fern Shen, the TIF for Port Covington, the development that Mr. Plank from Under Armour wants to do, it's a $5-point-something billion project. He's requested about $500 million in this TIF. What would it pay for? What would it cover?
It would cover infrastructure for this huge development that's been described as, you know, city within a city. We're talking about 7,500 homes, 200 hotel rooms, 1.5 million square feet of office space. And so this would be for the infrastructure for this huge development.
So it's so roads and
17
sewer.
17 streets, 60 intersections, and, you know, all the kind of pipes and infrastructure.
So Sagamore Development, which is the real estate arm of Under Armour and Mr. Plank, they would build the office. They would build the campus for Under Armour. They would build the homes and the hotels. But the city would supply the infrastructure to support all of that stuff.
Yeah, with this with financing this
right.
generated by this.
And this process begins with this group called the Baltimore Development Corporation. They're the first people to consider the, you know, advisability or lack thereof of this TIF, and then they make recommendations. Let's start with who the BDC, Baltimore Development Corporation, is. Who's on this board?
Well, it is a quasi-governmental organization. It has 17 members. It includes former Mayor Kurt Schmoke. It's got Paul Graziano, the head of the housing department. It's got Bank of America vice president, I believe, M&T Bank president. And interestingly, considering, you know, the momentousness of what they approve, no members from the community. I mean, no representatives, you know, really there to speak for neighborhoods.
All right. So the voters, as Joan said, don't vote on TIFs, but the city council does. How does it get to this from the Baltimore Development Corporation to the city council?
Well, what we've had to this point is a recommendation from the full board of the Baltimore Development Corporation that came after all these meetings that we're talking about where, you know, reporters were essentially kicked out of them. That was a committee of the BDC reviewing all the financials. So after them, after that recommendation, it goes to the mayor. The mayor then recommends it to the Board of Finance and to the Finance Department, and they promulgate legislation that goes to the city council.
So the city council will vote on it on behalf
yes.
of the voters.
Right.
But the voters themselves, it's not like a bond issue that shows up on certain ballots when we go to the polling place.
Right, right. I mean, that's the catch on TIFs. It was a way, you know, Mark explains this in his story, sort of legislatively through this sort of maneuvering to create something that is not scrutinized by the voters and yet is, you know, huge, mm-hmm. huge financing. So
Fern Shen from the Baltimore Brew. Joan Jacobson joins us as well, veteran reporter who was for more than 25 years with the Baltimore Sun. So Joan, these are controversial in part because it could also affect the bond rating of the city. And in this, Melody Simmons, our good friend, just wrote a piece earlier this week for the Baltimore Business Journal in which she described the process they're now recommending for this TIF from Under Armour to go through MEDCO, the Maryland Economic Development Corporation, and they would act as a conduit to hold the bonds. What does that do? What's the advantage to that for the city?
I think it would protect the city's bond rating in a certain sense and spread out the maybe the liability through the state. I'm not sure exactly how it would work, but Baltimore may be saturated with TIFs. There's, you know, I think $150 million in TIFs out there.
Yeah, I think there's 16 or 17 of
yes.
them currently in play. And as
right.
you mentioned, the EBDI in East Baltimore, this right. Development near Hopkins is one of them, but it's way behind schedule in terms of getting paid back.
Right. Well, they may be paying it back with other fees. For example, on a large piece of land that was to be a private biotech building that would have paid a lot of tax dollars. Instead, the Maryland Department of Health and Mental Hygiene put a building there, which of course doesn't produce taxes. So to pay that part of the TIF,
because it's a city,
it's a state-owned
building.
That's right.
Yeah.
The state of Maryland is paying about $500,000 a year to pay off the city's TIF. mm-hmm. which is not what it was intended
so
to do.
So at some point, it does come out of the taxpayer's pocket. It's up yes. because the state of Maryland is
sure.
paying it with taxes that state of Maryland citizens
right.
pay.
Right.
And so, Fernshand, you attended three, you and several other reporters from other publications attended three of these meetings, and they closed you out of each one. What is the reason that BDC, the Baltimore Development Corporation, gave for restricting or denying access by the press?
Well, they said that they're going to be looking at deep financing of this project and that they needed to be able to have the comfort and freedom to talk about this deep financing without the press around.
So there's financial records that they're uncomfortable sharing, and these are financial records from Sagamore or something? Did Sagamore request that these be kept private? I mean, how does that work?
The chairman, Arnold Williams, cited the topics they were going to discuss. He said they were going to talk about bonds, projected sales, debt service, financial detail.
So, Joan Jacobson, you've been covering this for a long time. This information at some point becomes public,
yes, of
right?
course. It's all public information. It should all be made public. In the case of EBDI, there were voluminous records that I read through, which were like a giant sales pitch to the purchasers of the bonds about everything that was going to happen in the project, what buildings were going to be built when and where and how many jobs
and
they would
plenty of, but also plenty of sensitive financial information?
No.
I mean, because Fern is saying that the BDC is saying that this information is so sensitive that somehow making it public would slow down the project or create problems in some way. What kind of problems?
I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe someone in the meeting just didn't want to speak publicly. And because it's a quasi-public organization, it's a nonprofit organization, but it's controlled by the mayor.
Well, maybe this is the point to say, you know, how sensitive this issue is right now and how, to me, kind of ironic it is that after the events of last year, after the uprising, the riots, the protests, people questioning the whole way that development is done and the trickle-down approach to development in this city, comes the biggest one of these TIF requests, you know.
Biggest one ever in the history of Baltimore, one of the biggest in the country.
In the history of the city, right.
Yeah.
Right. So, obviously this is going to be really under a microscope and it makes it less, you know, controversial if fewer details are out.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate both of you coming in and lending some light to this subject, and we will keep following it and have you back to talk about it more. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Fern Shen is the founder of The Baltimore Brew, a daily news website featuring investigative reporting and informed commentary about Baltimore and the region. Joan Jacobson is a veteran reporter who spent more than 25 years covering Baltimore City for the Baltimore Sun. She was last here on Maryland Morning to discuss her report for the Able Foundation on the city's Vacants to Value program. This has been the fifth installment of our monthly series, The Accountability Index, which we're presenting in conjunction with the Baltimore Brew. Stay tuned for more conversations in this ongoing series. We've got more information and a link to the Brew on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Coming up a little later, the award-winning reporter Alec McGillis on how local transportation policy going back more than 100 years has animated the racial and economic inequality that many have seen as sowing the seeds of violence in the uprising nearly a year ago. I'm Tom Hall, and you're listening to Maryland Morning on 88.1 WIPR. Stay with us.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us this morning. Now, another in a series of conversations as we approach the one-year anniversary of the riot that erupted following the funeral of Freddie Gray, a 25-year-old African-American man whose injuries sustained while in police custody led to his death last April. A year later, any number of panels and poets and pundits have weighed in as to the causes of the uprising that resulted in damage to nearly 400 businesses, almost 160 burned buildings and cars, more than 200 arrests, and dozens of injuries to police officers and civilians. But what have we really learned about the reasons for the racial and economic inequality that underpinned the unrest? Alec McGillis has written a terrific piece about the connection between transportation policy and inequality. It's been published in an online journal, Places, which covers journalism and scholarship related to, among other things, urban issues. Alec is an award-winning Baltimore-based reporter who covers politics for ProPublica. He was part of the team that won a Pulitzer Prize for the Washington Post for their coverage of the Virginia Tech shooting back in 2008. He has also written for Slate, The New Republic, and The Baltimore Sun. Alec McGillis joins me again this morning in Studio A. Good morning. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, Tom.
And congratulations are in order. Last month, you won the Toner Award for 2016. Very big deal in journalism. And the gentleman who spoke before you gave your acceptance speech was one Barack Obama. That must have been a pretty heady thing.
It was. It was a tough act to follow, yeah. Oratory-wise.
Indeed. Well, congratulations on that. It's well-deserved. In this piece that you've written, it's a series of pieces about inequality. And it's interesting that when you concentrate on transportation, I learned that Baltimore had a lot of firsts that I didn't know about. We had the first electric-operated streetcar in 1885. Mm-hmm. I-695, the Beltway, is the first metropolitan loop completed right. as part of the interstate system. All these things sound like good things, but you tie them to other these things animated other things like white flight that led to a whole history of right. of problems.
Yeah, when I started researching this piece, I was really kind of amazed. You know, I know Baltimore and the history of Baltimore pretty well, but I was really kind of astounded to see how the extent really of white flight and white abandonment in the city, and just how early it began, and just how extreme it really was. I think we have this, and this is how I sort of stumbled on the streetcar in the piece. We have this notion that white flight in Baltimore kind of happened after things started to go south. You know, white flight in Baltimore and other post-industrial cities happened when the jobs started to leave, the factories started to shut down, when crime got really bad in the late 60s, the riots in the late 60s. In fact, flight in Baltimore started happening much earlier than that. In some ways, it started happening earlier here than just about anywhere, way back at the start of the streetcar era in the late 19th century.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. I mean, because I think a lot of people do sort of date it from like the riots after Dr. King's
right.
death in 1968.
No, the really intense flight that happened in the city was starting in the 40s and early 50s. You lost between 1950 and 1970. You lost 243,000 white people from Baltimore, and again, that's ending in 1970. That's before Beth Steele, Western Electric, and a lot of the other big plants started to really to slow down. That's before things got really bad, crime-wise and drug-wise. So you had a flight from. There's different ways of looking at it, right? There's the sort of the happy picture of the story we tell ourselves about the move to the suburbs, that it was all about
the American dream.
You know, and this is what, you know,
Ta-Nehisi, the white picket fence
and the bigger yard and the bigger house, you know. But as you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates talks about this a lot in his new book, that what did that dream really mean? And you look at it in our town here, a lot of those homes that were being left behind in Baltimore, you know, in these gorgeous homes in Reservoir Hill and Bolton Hill and Butcher's Hill, you know, all these different, these great neighborhoods we have here that people were leaving behind. In a lot of cases, you were moving to a home in the suburbs that was in fact less grand, maybe even had less space than the one you had left. What was really going on with that move away? What were you moving away from?
In the 1940s, or in the year 1940, you write that Baltimore had the highest proportion of African Americans as a population in the 10 biggest U.S. cities. We were about 20% African American.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Baltimore, going way back to the 19th century, was one of, if not the most black of the large cities in the country, and that has a lot to do with the fact that the city, even before the Civil War, had a large population of free blacks, and then after the Civil War, a lot of newly freed African Americans moved to the city from Southern Maryland and points further south, and so when we think about that flight that started in 1890, you had people moving on, you know, with the streetcar sort of providing the conduit, you had people moving from an increasingly crowded and increasingly African-American, heavily African-American downtown areas to, you know, to the neighborhoods of our sort of first suburbs, the famous streetcar suburbs of Roland Park and the rest. And they are moving partly for, you know, the, those beautiful, it's, those are beautiful neighborhoods up there. They're, you know, famously beautiful neighborhoods, but they were also moving away from an urban scene downtown.
Yeah, and you write that transportation policy, both roads and public transportation, in many ways isolated Black communities to the point that you write that they may as well have been quarantined. I mean, it really just cut people off.
Exactly. I mean, we talk so much about the isolation of these neighborhoods, and that has many different aspects, but a big aspect of it is transportation. This city was supposed to get a serious mass rail transit system. In 1968, there was a plan announced.
Yeah, developed just a few months after the riot.
Just after the riot. It came out exactly the same time as Washington, D.C.'s plan for their metro. So Baltimore at the time was bigger, substantially bigger than Washington, D.C. It got it had its own plan for a metro system, a serious metro system. You were going to have, you know, three lines, you know, sort of crossing through downtown. And as we know, only two of those lines got built. It took a really long time.
Yeah, we should step back and say in 1968, what they proposed three things. One was kind of a U,
right,
that went, you know, so around in a U. The other went north-south.
Exactly.
And then the third was to be east-west. That was the red line.
That became the red line, yeah. Exactly.
But they never built them. I mean, these things in 1970, I mean, the transit system that we ended up with didn't get actually operating until 1983.
Right.
And you talk about the sort of the subtle and sometimes not so subtle animus towards the city of Baltimore by the Maryland state legislature, that even that you date back to the 18th century.
Yes. So there's this another thing I was fascinated to come across in my research was just how deep and longstanding the tension is between city of Baltimore and its suburban surroundings and the state of Maryland, that you have to go way back really to the founding of the city. Baltimore was founded relatively late compared to other, you know, great East Coast cities like Boston and Philly. And when Baltimore was founded, you already had a real power structure in Maryland, which was, you know, the state back then was run by the tobacco plantation owners, slave-owning tobacco plantation owners, who were the powers in Maryland. And they looked very much askance at this new city up on the Patapsco that didn't was not as slave dependent as the plantations, that was just going to be sort of a political rival, and to an extraordinary degree they were able to sort of keep this city down and keep it from even getting its own representation in Annapolis. Baltimore City, which was, you know, had quickly became one of the biggest cities in the country early on, did not get its own two representatives out of the 80 in the House of Delegates until well into the 19th century. It's just extraordinary just how much the state government of Maryland, going way back, has been really kind of reluctant to give Baltimore its due power and resources.
On 881 WIPR, you're listening to Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest this morning, Alec McGillis. He's written an extensive piece about transportation and its connection to inequality in an online journal called Places. The piece is called The Third Rail. Do you see parallels then between Governor Larry Hogan, a commercial real estate developer from Anne Arundel County, choosing rather than to build the red line and to ignore $288 million of investment, $900 million of federal money that was to have been made available in favor of, you know, road projects in less populated areas of the state? Is this just a continuation of literally what you date back to the 1700s?
I really do see it that way. Larry Hogan really kind of represented when he ran, it was easy to pick up on this if you watched him when he was running. He ran not so much as a conservative. He's not, you know, no one would really consider him a conservative ideologue. You've seen that in any number of, you know, issues in Annapolis, that he's not, you know, he does not come across that way. What he does embody is a real sort of regional resentment and skepticism and kind of distrust and alienation from the city of Baltimore. He was very open about the fact when he was running that he did not think much of mass transit and the Red Line, that he was going to spend more money on roads. And the mystery really for me is why the city didn't pick up on that more and why it didn't be, wasn't made clearer to the residents of Baltimore what the stakes of that election were. The turnout, of course, was just shockingly low in Baltimore City in that election. That was a big part of his victory. And why you had this huge project, and there were other issues, of course, as well, school funding, other things were on the line, but you had this huge project, the biggest infrastructure investment project the city had had in years, that was going to, you know, create 10,000 construction jobs, all this money pouring into the city, and also simply a project that was going to help a lot of people get around, and the fact that this was on the line just wasn't really clear to people, to a lot of people. And even after he got elected, there was this weird sort of silence around this big looming decision. It was kind of in this vacuum. It was as if no one kind of realized what was about to happen, and then it happened. And with a single stroke of a pen, he shut this thing down.
And what we're left with is we call it a metro system, but it's really that's a very loose application of that term. I mean, when you think about the Washington Metro, and right. you mentioned that these basically both started at about the same time, it's an interconnected thing. You can get off one train and get on the other and get to where you're going. The Paris Metro right. or the New York subway system, you can get on at one place and then get off after connecting at where you want to be. So what we're left with is something that's very disconnected and very difficult to...
Exactly. People like to mock our system and how low the ridership is. One reason the ridership is so low is that you don't have the interconnecting. For transit systems to work, you need to have connections. It's called the network effect. We have these two lines. They don't even meet. They come close to meeting. They don't actually meet. Meanwhile, Washington has this extraordinary network now. And what part of the sort of hard thing to swallow about the killing of the Red Line, of course, is at the very same time Governor Hogan did decide to proceed with funding the Purple Line, the new line.
And that was approved this week.
Exactly. This week they got their funding approved, a huge project that's actually, by some counts, going to cost more than the Red Line would have. It's a new line in the suburbs of Washington. And so you've got the system down there in Washington that's already vastly bigger and now is going to get even bigger. It's a really kind of a rich get richer situation. The inequality between cities like Washington and Baltimore just continues to grow with this decision.
And a lot of the ways that these lines have been sort of patched together, the decisions are premised in race and in fear of white communities, of black communities having access to their communities. You remind people about the phrase the loot rail.
The loot rail, right.
Which is what certain people in Ruxton referred to the light rail, and they were successful in diverting it so that it doesn't stop in Ruxton.
It goes right through the village. I mean, it's extraordinary. You go to Ruxton, it's this lovely little village, inner suburban village, and there's this light rail line that runs right through it. It's screaming out for a stop, and there's no stop. Anne Arundel County, too, of course, where Larry Hogan's from, did not want any kind of line down there at all. I believe that the loot rail term was kind of coined down there, in fact. Baltimore County did not want any kind of – I was very adamant about the fact that there be no actual sort of apartment development around its stops in the light rail and the metro. They did not want any – to draw out any sort of apartment dweller types with a line.
And you write about reminding folks that around Christmas time 2015, the NAACP filed a lawsuit saying that the money that was, allocated for mass transit was meant to benefit people in low-income situations. And in fact, it's now been diverted to like the Purple Line and road projects in Garrett County, and that's simply a violation of the intent of that allocation.
Exactly. This is actually a pretty big deal. It's quite unusual to have a civil rights claim brought on a transportation decision. It's very common, of course, with housing and other issues, but they're now challenging this on the basis of the Civil Rights Act, Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, saying that this was this money was, the legislature passed this, the new gas tax was passed, you know, largely with the intent to help fund this line that was going to benefit a mostly minority population in Baltimore. That money's now being shifted to these exurban, suburban, rural highways, and that there's a real sort of civil rights implication to that. The U.S. Department of Transportation has, in fact, accepted that they've started an investigation. The new Secretary of Transportation, Anthony Fox, is pretty serious about this, you know, the civil rights aspect of transportation. So they're actually looking into it. The state just filed their response to the complaint recently, and it was really a rather interesting response, sort of how they justify their decision.
Yeah. Well, of course, you know, the Central Maryland Transportation Alliance did a transportation report card back in December, saying that people living in the areas of the worst poverty have commutes that in many cases exceed, you know, 45 minutes or an hour, and that's directly linked to economic inequality.
And there's this big new report that came out that everyone's been talking about back around the time of the unrest, actually, about how bad social mobility is in Baltimore,
and they
explicitly linked that to transportation.
All right, well, we are out of time, but folks can take a look at this article. I really appreciate it. Alec McGillis covers politics for ProPublica. His article about inequality in transportation policy is called The Third Rail. We'll have a link to the online journal Places where you can read it at wipr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Lots more coming up. Stay with us. First, it's time for a Baltimore story with Gil Sandler.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Thanks, Nathan. Welcome back, everybody. You know, if you happen to be in Station North Arts and Entertainment District here in Baltimore on Sunday, you will notice a very, very large quilt blanketing North Avenue. The Monument Quilt is a collection of stories from survivors of sexual assault, written, stitched, and painted onto red fabric. The quilt is huge. It spans two city blocks, and on Sunday, it'll be on display on North Avenue, sprawling between Charles Street and Howard Street. The group behind the quilt is called Force, Upsetting Rape Culture. The organization kicked off their Not Alone Baltimore campaign last month through events and ads plastered on buses and billboards. The group raises awareness and support for sexual assault survivors. Rebecca Nagel and Hannah Brancato are the founders of Force, and they join me here in Studio A. Good morning to you both. Good to see you.
Good morning. Good morning.
So, Rebecca, Force aims to, as it says right in the title of your organization, to upset rape culture. What do you mean by rape culture?
So rape culture is the water we're swimming in, the air we're breathing. It's a set of laws, cultural norms, jokes, lines in TV shows that make coercion and violence seem normal and rape seem inevitable. So in a rape culture, rather than seeing rape as a problem that needs to be solved, people see it as just the way that things are. And so I think examples of how that plays out is people will say things like, you know, well, rape is just part of human nature or it's biological, rather than seeing it as something that can end.
I mean, the boys will be boys stuff, or, you know, the woman was dressed provocatively, therefore she had it coming, that kind of thing. I mean, what you're saying is that these have become so deeply ingrained in the conversation that we're inured to them. We're not sensitive to what people are actually saying.
Yeah, we're not naming rape culture as a problem that can be solved.
And Hannah, what goes into making this quilt? I mean, this is a big quilt. I mean, you're covering city blocks worth of street here. How did you collect the stories? What's the process behind making this thing?
Sure. The Monument Quilt is a collection of stories from survivors of sexual and domestic violence. And so people from all across the country, from about 30 states so far, have made their own quilt squares. They contain messages of support for survivors, as well as people's own personal narratives and stories about about survival, about what happened to them. So people write and stitch and paint them onto red fabric and then mail them into our studio in Baltimore. And we stitch them together into 8-foot blocks that we display. We've displayed the quilt 25 times, 28 times today in 25 different cities. So it's growing and growing.
Is there a place that this quilt's ever going to stop? I mean, do you have a place where we're going to, you know, we're not going to have any more quilt?
Yeah, the vision is for the monument quilt to blanket the National Mall with the phrase "not alone." So it'll be over 1 mile of the National Mall, 6,000 stories from survivors during a week-long display, during which time statistically the same number of people will be victimized by sexual or domestic violence. And so really it makes us confront the scale of this, you know, this issue that really does happen in epidemic proportions. It's a crisis that we have to confront.
That's Hannah Brancato. She's here with Rebecca Nagel. They are the animating force behind Force Upsetting Rape Culture. The monument quilt will be displayed on North Avenue Sunday afternoon. Rebecca, you wrote a really poignant, powerful essay in The Sun a couple of days ago about, talk about your own experience as a survivor of childhood sexual abuse. And one of the common threads, as it were, between survivors is this feeling of isolation. So the quilt is a way of manifesting and sort of seeing the fact that you are literally not alone.
Yeah, I think that the most common experience for survivors is to feel alone, to feel isolated. You know, we live in a culture where we're meant to doubt ourselves, doubt our own experiences, feel like it's our fault. And there's not a lot of models for community support. So I think that the monument quilt does two things. One, for communities that I think often don't know where to start with this topic and feel overwhelmed, it's a tangible way to support survivors. And I think for survivors, it's really important that our voices are centered in these discussions of what needs to change and that we have the space to organize, to come together, and to say what we need. And so if you think about rape as a political issue, being socially isolated from each other actually limits our ability to affect the policies, affect the culture that needs to change. And so the quilt is also a platform for us to organize.
Mm-hmm. And Hannah, at the event on Sunday, you've got commitments from some of the women running for the Democratic nomination for mayor of Baltimore, Catherine Pugh, Sheila Dixon, Elizabeth Embry. When you hear from them, what would you like to hear? What sort of policy changes should be enacted to address this very serious issue?
Yeah, so we had a survivor town hall at University of Baltimore on Wednesday night. About 100 people came out from both, you know, different agencies and service organizations, as well as survivors ourselves. And in breakout groups, people began to set priorities for what they would like to see our mayor work on. Some of the things that rose to the surface are education. So at an earlier age, educating children about childhood sexual abuse, about consent and healthy relationships. Another thing that rose to the top is that people are at risk of homelessness for leaving abusive relationships. So we want to know about how, you know, the mayor, the potential mayor will address that issue. We also have heard from survivors a couple of other issues that Rebecca can tell you more about.
So one of the big themes was that survivors really want to be in positions of leadership. So a lot of times, you know, we're treated like we're too fragile or upset to have clear ideas about these issues. And so Baltimore has a sexual assault response team. So one of the things we'll be asking the candidates for mayor is for a third of that steering committee to be made up of survivors. So it's not just professionals, it's survivors. And then we also really want some changes to how Baltimore City police respond to domestic violence and sexual assault. In the first 3 months of 2016, over 6,000 911 calls have been made for domestic violence. So the police are responding to this every day. And what we've heard from survivors is really disturbing. You know, we've heard stories from survivors who they themselves were arrested by the police. And so the DOJ actually put out guidelines for how police departments, policies that police departments should adopt. And so we're asking the candidates for mayor to implement those in Baltimore.
I'm interested also in the tactics of force upsetting rape culture. You did a thing with Victoria's Secret a few years ago where you sort of did a, and you call yourself a guerrilla art group. Hannah, talk about, first of all, the connection between quilting and social justice. And, you know, Rebecca's very involved in the No Boundaries Coalition. As, you know, so social justice work comes second nature to her. Are you finding that these tactics are working and you're cutting through the morass here?
Yeah, so, you know, when we're talking about rape culture, we're talking about the fact that we need to change the visual landscape that we live in, and we need to create other alternatives. So in Force's work, we, like, literally create an experience where people can see that we can live in a different world. With Victoria's Secret, you know, it was imagining that brands and companies would promote consent on the level that we pretended that Victoria's Secret did with that underwear. With the Monument quilt, when you're in that quilt, you're having a microcosm experience.
Because the underwear said something like, just say no or something, or no means no.
Yeah, so the underwear said things like, ask first, no means no, let's talk about sex. So it just normalizes that idea.
All right, well, it's great to see you both, and let's hope the weather holds out for you on Sunday, and thanks for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Rebecca Nagel and Hannah Brancato are the founders of Force Upsetting Rape Culture. The Monument quilt will be on display Sunday, weather permitting, at North Avenue between Charles Street and Howard Street. Details about the event will be on our website, wipr.org/Marilyn Morning. Marilyn Morning's director, engineer, and co-host is Nathan Sterner. The show is produced by Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill. Lauren Ferguson's our intern. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Marilyn Morning theme music, Coffee, for our guests, provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. They're online at zekescoffee.com. That's it for us today. On Monday, we'll have a preview of Sine Die in the Maryland legislature with Rachel Bay. We'll also talk to folks from Strong City, Baltimore, and the Associated Black Charities about the Neighborhood Institute coming up. We'll have a theater review from J. Wynn Russick and Sheila Cast. We'll talk to Ambassador Dennis Ross. Hope you can join us Monday morning on Maryland Morning. Until then, thanks so much for listening. Garrison Keillor's up next. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.